All right, so again, I said you've got a handout, and we finished up the specifically Luther and the Lutheran Reformation part of the class last week, and you know, we were watching segments of the video, then discussing and asking questions about that. We finished that up last week. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at what happened next with the Lutherans. What happened after Luther died, and then touch a little bit on even, you know, going a little further down the road. But you can see there we're going to focus on especially these, first of all, these years from 1546 to 1580. Those are critical years there, as we're going to see what happens there. What my experience has been, maybe yours is different, but that even though this is so important, most Lutherans don't know a whole lot about this. Like I said, we kind of know the highlights of Luther's career, right? We know about the thunderstorm. We know about him becoming a monk. We know about the 95 Theses. We know about the Diet of Worms. We know maybe about the Augsburg Confession, you know, all these things. And then Luther dies and Lutheranism is established and we all live happily ever after, right? Not exactly, right? Not exactly. So there's a lot that happens there in these years that we're going to see as critical. And of course, there's a lot that happens after that. But I did want to spend a little time looking at that this morning, because I think this is a kind of a blind spot for us, these forgotten years. You don't hear a lot of sermons and Bible studies on it, but it's incredibly important. In the elders, I guess, I don't know, the last year and a half or so, we've been looking at the formula of Concord, right? And we hadn't even got to the actual document yet. But, you know, every month we spend a little bit of time, or every other month when we meet, and we went through the history of this, what you're going to learn. So, David, some of this will be reviewed to you, you know, but it's always good to review. But does anyone disagree with that assessment? Like, say, oh, no, Pastor, we've been taught all about what happened after Luther died up to 1580. Anybody? Okay, well, that's good and bad. It's good because you're about to learn it. It's bad because my thesis of we're not doing a good job teaching this is correct. I mean, even in confirmation, I mean, there's only so much stuff we can cover, obviously. I mean, you'd be doing it for 10 years, you know, before you get to take communion. That's the, you know, that's probably a little long. Even in the early church, it was only 3 years, you know. It's something I think that we do need to know about and to understand. So we're going to talk about that. And as I said, this summary, I basically summarize what's in here. We'll talk about this edition of the Book of Concord a little later if we get that far, but it gives a pretty good overview of the history in here. So the first part of this, the notes are heavily summarized from that, so I did want to credit that source. So February 18th, 1546, so we're in February now, so not too much longer, we'll get to the anniversary of this. What happened on that day? Luther died. Luther dies. How old was Luther?
62.
62, right? So that's right there. No, so he was 62. So I mean, that's a pretty good lifespan for that time. Okay, today it's below the average. I think lifespan in America is like 77, 78 years today. So, you know, if you're older than that, you've already beat the average, okay? But remember, in the medieval times, people could die very quickly and suddenly. But if you made it past early childhood, you might live for a little while. Now, something could still get you. You know, you could be out gathering mushrooms in the forest and get eaten by a wolf or something. You know, anything could happen. Okay, but you know, in the early times, a lot of our infant mortality rate today is much lower than it was in other times of history, because we have all these, you know, interventions and medicine and everything like this. But this was not crazy. You know, people did live longer than this, but 62 is a pretty good life span. But we also learned Luther, was he in good health most of his life, his adult life? No, he was always battling different illnesses and things like that. For, you know, we know genetics plays a role in that. We know lifestyle plays a role in that. Stress, obviously. I mean, you want to talk about a guy under stress, Smart Luther, you know. And so so he dies, and he basically died of heart failure. You know, he faced a lot of challenges during his time, from intestinal things to mental things to physical things. He thought he was going to die at certain periods in his life, but basically his heart just gave out in 1546. And Luther dies, and he's mourned throughout the Lutheran territories of the Holy Roman Empire, of what would be part of Germany today. And an interesting fact about Martin Luther, again, one of the towering figures of the history of the world, he was born and he died in the same little town, Eisleben. Still a pretty small town in Germany today. This little town called Eisleben. The same little town. He was born and he died there. And it's interesting because he spent very little of his life in Eisleben. He was born there and his family lived there when he was really, really young, but then they moved to Mansfeld as his father expanded the business. So he didn't even really grow up in Eisleben. And then what happened was he was often called on later in his life to settle disputes in Germany. And there was a dispute in his hometown, and they had summoned him there. His wife's like, I don't know if you should go because you're not really doing real well now. But of course, Luther went, and he never came back. While he's there in Eisleben, he works to resolve this dispute, and then he dies. So it's just kind of an interesting fact of history. He was born and died in this kind of little, what we say, insignificant town. But it's not like he stayed there his whole life. He was there very little in his life, but he was born there and he died there. Okay? So the question at hand here to think about is on there, how did the death of Martin Luther present an opportunity for religious and political opponents of the Reformation? Why did the death of Luther, as he's being mourned and, you know, his casket is going through Germany and he's eventually buried in the church in Wittenberg, how do his opponents say this could be a good thing for us?
They can push their own agendas.
That's what I'm saying. Basically, yeah. I mean, Luther is such a towering figure, right, of the Reformation and was so effective, and he had, you know, he ended up having some friends in high places like Frederick the Wise. I mean, they basically, as we learned about, they felt they couldn't just go in there and like nab it, you know? But once Luther dies, they say, well, this is all really centered around this troublemaking former monk. So now we can move to bring these people back under our control of politically and religiously. Okay, so they see this as this is the opportunity to strike, okay, against these rebel factions as they see them. Now, there were certainly politics involved here, right, as we've learned. There were certainly politics and powers. There were certainly theological issues that were at stake, right? But despite all of that, when we think of all the things that are at stake, what is the most vital thing that is at stake here after Luther's death? Okay. All right. Yeah. So they don't want like this, remembering of Luther to take root. Okay, that's good. But specifically for us sitting here today, what's the number one issue that is at stake that we don't want to lose? All right, David's got us. I was hoping somebody would get the true word of Christ, which is the gospel, right? Okay, so all these political angles, all the, you know, these geopolitical angles, everything, and even a lot of the theological issues, you know, is the mass going to be in Latin or German? A lot of that comes back to the gospel. But the main thing is the gospel. That's what the tragedy would be if the Reformation was stopped and the gospel was taken away again from the center of the church. That would be the true tragedy, right? That is the greatest legacy of Luther and the Reformation, is that the gospel was brought back to its rightful place, that everything is about Christ and what he has done for us. So really, the gospel is at stake here. And that is the most important thing we don't want to lose. That is central to everything we're talking about here. Okay? Not just who's going to be the political leader. All right, so with all of this, what we've talked about, we have to remember there, and it says on the notes here, I've pretty much summarized everything we're going to talk about here, hopefully, unless we go on some rabbit trails, but which does happen, right? But We have to understand that, again, it wasn't Luther did this and we all lived happily ever after. There was a lot of bloodshed and struggle that was going to happen, because if things went the wrong way, everything that Luther worked for, everything that the reformers pushed for, could have been lost. Okay? Pretty easily, we're going to say. It all could have been lost, and then we go back to the way it was before, maybe with a few reforms, but, you know, Rome's going to be like, hey, we won, start doing it our way again. Which would be, obviously, very bad, you know, because of the diminishing of the gospel. So I think we need to understand that. Why are we talking about all this? Because we need to appreciate and understand what happened here and how close this was. Again, there's so many points we talked about. If Luther had caved, or he went a different direction, or, as we're going to see, after he died, if certain things had happened, Luther would probably just be a footnote in history. You know, when you studied history, they'd be like, oh, there's this German monk, he caused a little trouble, was preaching these doctrines Rome didn't like, but then they put a stop to it. Okay? I mean, Luther would just be a footnote in history. And that could have still happened after 1546. All right? So we need to understand that this is very important, this critical time. It's kind of like, you know, in American history, I'm always drawing the parallels there, teach that, okay, we got the Declaration of Independence, right? What a wonderful thing. It would be simply a footnote in history if we had lost the Revolutionary War, right? Okay? Well, there's this, you know, the colonies started a little trouble. They wrote this document that philosophers did, but then they got crushed. No, but we won the war, right? Same thing, even after we won the war, if we were not able to formulate an effective constitution and have a government with leaders that worked, we would have become a footnote in history. Well, they won the war, and that was all great, but then they just devoured themselves. The whole thing fell apart. Okay, and then we don't have the United States. We just have maybe some, you know, individual little countries, like kind of like Germany at the time, you know, little city, like a little fiefdoms, you know, each state's kind of ruling the territory. So there's always this in history that these great things happen, but then a lot of times they could be reversed, okay, if things had gone another way. And there's probably a lot of things in history we can say that, well, this person did this, but then, you know, kind of all fell apart, okay? So I think that's important to appreciate. Okay, so after Luther dies, Charles V, who is a little bit older now, more seasoned than he was back in 21, he's about 40 now, and he's had, you know, a good bit of time running this empire, and he says, this is the time, right? This is the time. Okay, Luther, he stood up to me at the Diet of Worms, and now is my time to move and put an end to this. And so he enters into a secret agreement with the Pope, because the Pope wants Luther gone too. Or, you know, Luther's dead, but he wants to stop this. He says, this is the time to do it. And again, the Pope has religious and political concerns here, because, you know, other parts of the Catholicism may break away. And Charles, frankly, has religious and political concerns. Now, he's a political leader. He wants the states to be united and under his rule. But Charles was personally a religious person. As we said, he did care about the theology. I mean, some politicians don't. They just use religion as a tool to, you know, hey, this works. You know, this is going to be good. You know, a tragedy happens, so I say God is watching over us and is going to see us through. People like to hear that, so I'm going to say it. Okay? But Charles really did. He was a true believer. As I said, in the end, he becomes frustrated by all this and goes and becomes a monk somewhere. Okay? That's what he does. Okay? So Charles and the Pope get together and they say, well, now it's time to bring these rebel Germans back under Rome and Holy Roman Empire control again. Now, again, when I say Germany, I'm not talking about the modern nation of Germany. Remember, we say German, there were Germanic peoples, but they were divided into these different kingdoms, right? These different kind of city-states. I mean, it really wasn't until the late 1800s that Germany, as we think of Germany today, becomes a nation, actually. Okay, where they're united under one government. Same thing with Italy. You know, we used to call it Italians. Yeah, there were lots of Italian people, but they all had these little principalities throughout Italy. It was about the same time that Germany and Italy, like the 1870s, somewhere around there, if I'm remembering correctly, they become what we would think of as those countries today. Now, of course, the borders shift a little bit and all that, but when I say Germany and Germans here, I'm talking about this region, which is made up of different basically small kingdoms or city-states within this overarching empire. All right, so they say, now is the time. Because the Holy Roman Empire is powerful, right? They're the most powerful empire, at least in this part of the world. They have a big army that can fight. They've been fighting wars. And so they have a lot of power at their disposal. So they see the death of Luther here. Now is the time. This is the time to strike. Because Luther is gone. Their great leader is gone. So what you have here is, as you can see on the study guide, what happens is the small Caldic War. Okay, again, I would not be surprised if some of you have never heard of this, okay? But it's important. Okay, the small Caldic War breaks out. Now, how does that go for the Lutheran princes? Not good, David. Yet, David says you're exactly right. It goes horribly because, again, they are much smaller in size, number, and troops at their disposal than the whole empire is now moving against them. The emperor and the pope is moving against them. As I'm writing this, like, I can't help but think about, like, Star Wars. You know, you have, like, the empire is moving against these rebels, and you have all the stormtroopers come in. So I don't know why I thought of that. Maybe none of you would, but that's kind of what I think of here. So I guess the Pope would be Darth Vader here, maybe. Okay, can we say Luther probably would be fine with that, you know, calling that. But so we have the empire here is moving against the Lutherans, and it goes pretty bad. There's a key battle that happens. The Battle of Muhlberg takes place on April 24th, 1547. So you can see that's only a little bit after a year, Luther. So with a year and a couple months after Luther dies, the empire's already organized, they've moved, and they've basically crushed the Lutheran forces on the battlefield. All right? The final blow comes. The army of the empire now moves against the seat of the Reformation, which is, of course, where? Wittenberg. The army approaches. The city surrenders without a fight. They have been so broken by this point, they're like, well, we don't want the city to get sacked. We don't want to die. So they just surrender, and the Holy Roman Empire marches in to Wittenberg itself and takes the city. Now, Charles V... to his credit, again, giving him credit where credit is due, he was not a hothead and an unwise ruler. He was an enemy of the Lutherans, but I mean, he at least had some moral compass, as we said. Like, he honored the agreement. Remember, he said, if Luther comes to Worms, well, we won't kill him. And he honored that. Okay, he was misguided in his opinions, obviously, but he did try to be a man of his word in many cases. And this, when they get into Wittenberg, what do a lot of his soldiers want to do? Let's destroy this place and let's dig Luther up. Let's dig him up and let's burn that heretic's body. Let's burn him up. Okay, this is our chance. We can really get back at Luther. You know, they would do that to people, right? Poor John Wycliffe, who translated the Bible into English in Britain, he was like dug up, I think it was 50 years later. They burned his body, threw his ashes in the Thames River. Okay, just for good measure. He was declared a heretic after he died. And they, you know, good for translating the Bible. How horrible, right? Is what Wycliffe did. But so Charles V, to his credit, he does not do this. Okay, he says, no, this is not what we came to do. He said, essentially, I have come to make war on the living, not the dead. And he refuses to allow his forces to dig up Luther's body and to desecrate it. Yeah, it says there, I make war on the living, not the dead, he said. And again, this was his enemy. This is a guy that stood up to his face at Worms, kind of, you know, really, you know, that's that. Most people would be like, yeah, if I could have a chance to burn this guy up, I would, but he didn't do it. Okay, question or comment, David?
Often through the, you know, enemies respect each other, you know, in war.
Yeah, so a lot of times they do.
And he understood that. He was Luther definitely important, but yeah. He didn't. They didn't
right. Yeah, there are lots of examples of that in history. Yeah. There's some the other way, too, but, you know, where these opponents begin. I mean, in the American Civil War, you know, Grant and Lee developed a respect for each other when the war ended. You know, there were a lot of people who wanted to kind of take revenge on the Confederate Army, and Grant said no. You know, they've surrendered and that's it. I think he said, like, the rebels are our countrymen again or something to that effect. You know? Go ahead.
Oh, we sort of do something like that, but they said, well, I'm fine. They put it in the ocean unmarked, so nobody would give. You got to have a place to revere that person, a place to gather. And so Charles V kind of left the place.
Yep. People. And what can you do to this very day? You can go to Wittenberg and you can look, and Martin Luther is right under there. He's still there. Has anybody done that? I haven't. One day. We're going to do one day, okay? Church trip, field trip, right? It'd be great. You know, some churches have done it, like a tour of the Reformation sites or whatever. Do some fundraisers or something for that. But yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it? But so you're exactly right. So there is that element of, you know, just as a revenge, but as a practical thing, you don't want this to be a shrine to that. You know, if they're trying to get rid of Luther's memory, you know, get rid of his grave. What about Adolf Hitler? Does he have a grave people can go visit?
No.
Like you said, Bin Laden? Nope. He dropped out the ocean somewhere.
Jimmy Hoffa,
there's Kent's thing, right? Jimmy Hoffa, yeah, so you're going to find that out, though, right? You said you're going to answer that question one day if it's in heaven. Where's the Hoffa body, right? Where's that? I know Kent has said he has interest in this, what happened to him. But you're right, but they don't do that. So to this day, you can go to Wittenberg and you can see, here's Martin Luther's burial site. And we can see that. So, oh, there's Luther. He's buried right there. So it's a good thing Charles didn't do that. But the situation of the small Protestant war coming to a close, it's pretty bad for us, isn't it? Okay, Luther's gone, and Rome has moved, and we have been defeated militarily. Essentially, our capital has been taken. And we are now defeated militarily by Rome, by the Holy Roman Empire. So again, I mean, it's very easy to see all of this could have been, this looks pretty bad. All of this could have ended, right? So only a little more year after Luther dies, things are already falling apart because we're getting militarily crushed. Okay? Now, what stopped this from, you say, well, how are we still even here today then if Rome just came in, they took over, they crushed our forces, and now they're back in control? Well, of course, when we study history, we understand God is behind that, right? You just say, well, how did the Bible come together? Well, God was working there to bring it all together, okay, to preserve his word. You know, how did Luther accomplish all these things? How come he didn't die? Well, God is preserving him, right? The same thing here, that what happened was they had militarily won, but is it easier in history to conquer an enemy in a, like, taking their territory, or is it harder to keep the peace afterwards oftentimes? Keep the peace. That's a little bit harder. We can look at pretty recent American history and see that. Okay, Saddam Hussein went down pretty quickly when our military went in, right? In a matter of weeks, you know, the whole thing, Iraq has fallen, and, you know, he's, you know, found carried in a hole and arrested. 10 years later, we're still there. Our guys are still dying, right? Okay? So you can kind of break the back of somebody geopolitically, but oftentimes it's a little bit harder with the hearts and minds, isn't it? Okay? Vietnam War, going back a little further. America wins every open battle in the Vietnam War. Yet we essentially lose the war because we could go home. Okay? There wasn't enough support for the South Vietnamese government we were propping up. Okay? Not enough political will to stay in it. Okay? If you're China, you can stay in as long as you want because people can't do anything about it. In America, politicians are like, well, we're going to get voted out, so let's get out of there, you know? So, this is what the Holy Roman Empire discovered. When they took over, the people didn't just say, oh yes, great, let's just become Catholic again. Let's submit to the Pope again. Because Luther and the Reformers had done such a good job. They had got the Bible in the words of the people. He had straightened out the preachers who didn't know anything with the catechisms and the small catechisms being taught in the family. The preachers are preaching the Bible. They're preaching the gospel. And guess what? God's word did exactly what he promised it would do, Kent, right?
What's one of your favorite verses? The word of God will not return void. The lion was let out of the cage, wasn't it? So many, many people in these areas, they had truly been converted to Christ, and they were willing to keep on fighting for this. Okay, well, you can topple Wittenberg, you can even dig up Luther's body and burn it if you want, but you know what? We believe what he taught us from the scripture. So the Holy Roman Empire quickly realized, and Charles, again, is pretty savvy here. He's not just one who flies off the handle. He realizes if we want to crush the spirit of what has been planned here, the Holy Spirit, really, of course, he didn't see it that way, but if we want to crush the spirit, what are they going to have to do? They're going to kill a lot of people. I mean, this is going to have to be scorched earth. Anybody who, you know, disagrees with us, off with their head. You know, probably public hangings and executions. I mean, you're going to have to go in there hardcore with a bloodbath and just annihilate people. And that's happened in history too. Some have been willing to do that. But even that, you look at the Soviet Union, 70 years of communist rule, and some of it pretty oppressive, you know, at times. Did it destroy the Russian Orthodox Church? No, it did not. Okay, you look at Eastern Europe. I should have mentioned this last week. I was saying Luther inspiring reforms around the world. All of you remember 1989, right? Okay, we're all old enough to remember 1989. What happened in Germany, 1989? The Berlin Wall came down. But what maybe is not quite as remembered, it's not like all these people just woke up one day and said, let's go knock the wall down in East Germany. Because there were guards there with guns and everything, right? What had been going on for the seeds of it had been planted earlier, but what had been going on weeks before, maybe some of you, you remember this, or documentary, there's a city in Germany, East Germany, called Leipzig. And in the city of Leipzig, people were marching through the streets with candles. They were marching peacefully, but there were so many of them, they couldn't just shoot them or arrest them. I mean, we're talking like 70,000 people marching through the streets of the city peacefully. And the German, East German Stasi, the secret police, and the military, they were like, what do we do? That started the whole thing. And when that wasn't stopped, then people said, let's go tear down the wall. Well, guess who started this peaceful protest movement in Leipzig? It was a Lutheran pastor of a church in the city, Pastor Wonenberger. Wonenberger in German. And for 10 years, he had been holding prayer meetings in his church. And that's what started the whole thing. Okay? Well, who do you think he was inspired by? Luther. How are we going to get rid of this godless communism? Well, we can do it. Luther did it. That's how it started. In Romania, where Ceausescu, you guys have been to Romania, right? You tell me? One of the most brutal dictators. Same thing. It was not a Lutheran pastor, but it was a Protestant pastor in Timisoara. He started a peaceful protest. They went in, they shot some people. Then that was the end. It broke out throughout the country. One pastor saying, well, we're going to be doing this. And actually, even before that, there was a guy named Richard Weinberg. I think I'm saying his name right. He started this thing called the Voice of the Martyrs, which is still around. And he was actually raised, he was Jewish by ethnicity. He was Romanian. He converted to Christianity in college. And guess what? He became a Lutheran pastor. And he ended up in the Romanian prison system and remained faithful. He started this whole movement of persecuted Christians, and his organization still continues to work. So Luther had inspired all of these things, either directly or indirectly. Okay, so the spirit of the Reformation is not easily broken. Again, even East Germany and Romania, they tried the bloodbath method. You know, they had your neighbors could be working for the secret police. You didn't know that. They still couldn't destroy what God had started. Okay? So Charles, being wise, he says, well, I've got to handle this diplomatically. Okay? We can't just go in there. We could go in there and start killing everybody, but that might make it worse. Okay? He's not willing to do that. So he says, well, let's pursue a diplomatic solution to all this, a compromise. So out of this, you get something called the Augsburg Interim, and that's on your sheet there. Okay, the Augsburg Interim. And this is issued May 15th, 1415.
1548. So again, we're not too long after Luther's died, just a little more than 2 years. And this proposed a system, and what Charles said here in this document was, okay, Lutherans, you guys can keep calling yourselves Lutherans. You can still get together in your churches. You can still give people communion in both kinds. You can give them both the bread and the wine. You keep doing that. But you have to acknowledge the Pope is the head of the church. Okay? You have to acknowledge the Pope is the head of the church. You have to accept transubstantiation. And no more talking about this justification by faith alone business. Okay? You laugh. And even the Pope thought this was giving the Lutherans too much. You know, he wasn't happy with it. But Charles says, this is what we got to do. You kind of, you know, made a displeasing sound here. Because what would this do? This just guts the whole thing, right? Especially that, you know, you can't talk about, you can't preach about justification by grace through faith anymore. So, again, this is a political, we still get to be Lutherans, but not really. Because you can call yourself something, but that doesn't really mean you are, right? Okay, you're just the shell of what used to be, okay? So this is the compromise, though. He says, well, this is what we'll do. We'll let them keep some of the stuff. But they got to acknowledge the Pope's in charge and no justification by faith. And these are really, those are the big things, right? Okay? So the Lutherans here are in a difficult situation. As I said, this whole thing could have gone away. Because they can't turn to Luther anymore. He's buried in the floor of the church. They've been militarily crushed and occupied, and now they're having this system imposed on them. So the question there is, what were the Lutherans to do? What were they to do? I mean, they've been militarily defeated, politically defeated. What are the options here? There's really two big ones. What that, you know, throughout history, you really got these two options. When it comes to them, what are the options? Accept it or not. Accept it or not. Well, okay. Accepting it, it may preserve something, some semblance of the Reformation, but, you know, it's being gutted, you know, here. But if you say don't accept it, what does that mean is going to happen now? Yeah, you're going to be persecuted. Okay, and there's so many things we can point to in history, right? People have had to make a decision. Well, do we just grudgingly go along with this? And, you know, maybe preserve our way of life or whatever, maybe our own lives? Or do we fight back? Do we refuse to comply? And if you do take that route, that's harder, isn't it? Because then you start getting into the Sermon on the Mount stuff, right? What was Jesus talking about? We heard last week, all these things are going to come to those that follow me, the persecution and men speaking evil of you and all of this. So there were a good many of the Lutherans who said, we are not going to abide by this thing. We are going to defy this. We're going to Acts 5:29 this, where we say we follow God rather than men. You know, that's what we always go to, right? And with that, this interim was brutally enforced. There were 400 pastors that were imprisoned that refused to say, well, we're not doing this in our church. I'm not going to tell people the Pope's in charge. I'm not going to tell them transubstantiation is right. I'm not going to not preach justification by faith alone. They were nabbed, sent to prison. Numerous lay people were put into jail. They were beaten, even killed, as examples. Other people did, as others through history too. Well, there's another option, Krista. You could run away to go somewhere else. How do people get all over the world? These things, right? Why are there so many people from Venezuela here right now? Because it stinks in Venezuela right now. You know, it's the country's dysfunctional. Okay? Don't adopt socialism. There's your lesson for today. This is what happens. You know, full-blown socialism. They got, like, the most oil in the Western Hemisphere. But they're, like, they ate animals out of the zoo to survive. Okay, it's not going well. Okay, so people flee. They go somewhere else. Okay, so many fled into exile. They said, well, we're just going to go somewhere else.
get away from this. So it's not an easy time. What about the political leadership? Well, the political leader was good. John Frederick, the brother of the former elector, Frederick the Wise. John Frederick, who is given the nickname there, what? Magnanimous. I always have trouble saying that word, so I asked, what else have we got there? Again, these great nicknames, right? You know? So imagine if you had one of these titles after your name. He was a true believer in the Reformation. He said, we can't do this. So guess what happened to him? He got thrown in prison. He got thrown in prison too. And despite being imprisoned, he stands firm. He will not recant. And it's in this reader's edition. It's kind of long, so I won't read it. I think we did in the elders' meeting, but he basically writes this letter to Charles V saying, you know, this isn't going to happen. And he would spend all his time studying his Bible while he was in prison there. And he says, whoever shall deny me before men, I will also deny him before my Father in heaven. He quotes Jesus saying, I'm not going to do it. And he says, my conscience will not allow me to cave here. So then they say, well, we're going to take the Bible away from John Frederick here, so he can't read that thing anymore. So they take his Bible away. And he says, you can deprive me of my books, but you can never take out of my heart what I've learned from it. So this guy, man, he was stood firm. He said, you can cut my head off, I'm not backing down. But he's in jail. So another member of the family named Maurice comes to power. And Maurice is willing to work with the occupiers. Okay? So while his cousin, John Frederick, languishes in jail, Maurice cooperates and says, we need to compromise here. Okay? So there were those that stood firm. But there were others who said, well, really, like Charles here, let's, you know, Charles is making some olive branch. He's making some effort here. Let's meet him halfway. I mean, it's not ideal. It's not ideal. But at least we'll what? We'll get to survive. We'll get to, you know, worship in our churches and have some of the things and go on about our lives. So they see that, you know, let's work with them. Let's compromise. All right? To erase some of this here, because run out of room here. I should have left that one, but already erased this. The gospel is at stake, don't forget that. Okay, so I'm going to, a guy that he was briefly mentioned in the video, but a name that we need to know is Philip Melanchthon, which was not his actual last name. A lot of the reformers took names after, you know, different, like, Greek philosophers, things like that. But he was known as Philip Melanchthon, okay? It's always one of those unpronounceable words you read that. Was it Melanchthon? There's a Melanchthon, okay? And Philip Melanchthon, is he important for Lutherans? Yes. Next to Luther, I mean, he's a big deal. Because guess what he did? He wrote the Augsburg Confession. He wrote this beautiful defense of the Augsburg Confession. He wrote the treatise on the power and the primacy of the Pope, basically saying he doesn't have any. He shouldn't have primacy and power. And all these are confessional documents. He was Luther's right-hand man. Remember in the video when they brought him in? He was near death and Luther praised the God. You can't take Philip Melanchthon. We need Philip Melanchthon. And he got better. Okay? So after Luther dies, Melanchthon is the obvious choice for Luther's successor, right? I mean, who has the resume that he has? Who had the trust of Luther that Melanchthon had? So I say that because we don't want to forget the good things Melanchthon did. And he never abandoned the faith or anything like that. I believe, you know, he trusted, you know, Christ. And he has a commemoration day on our church calendar. I mean, his contributions are huge. However, all that being said, after Luther died, what does he do? He is willing to compromise. Now again, in his view, he's saying, I don't really agree with this, but we've got to do it to survive. If we don't compromise, look what's happening. 400 pastors in jail. People being killed, beaten. You know, fleeing the country. He said, we've got to compromise. We can't fight this. Okay? So what they do
is they come up with a kind of a counter-compromise, and they call this the Leipzig. Remember, I mentioned Leipzig earlier, right? It's an important Reformation city. The Leipzig intern. And this wanted to push a little bit further than what Charles was offering to get some of our practices back. Okay, push a little bit further. And it was written, again, Melanchthon's brilliant guy. And if you ever read some of these academic things, as I'm smiling as I read this, and politicians are good at this too. They usually have people draft it for them, lawyers. And you can say something without really saying something, can't you? You can read a very careful, y'all are laughing, right? You know this. Happens in the church too, you know. An apology without an apology, right? You know, so this was very carefully drafted to be purposefully vague. Okay, where Charles could read what he wrote about justification and say, okay, I can live with that. But then Lutherans could read it and say, yeah, I can live with that too. Okay? So it was on the points of contention, it was purposely vague to try to please everyone. Okay? Back in 2000, there was a document that many Lutheran bodies signed on with Rome, and it's basically the same thing. It sounds good, but say, oh, we all agree on justification now. It's by faith. But the problem is Rome's defining those terms differently than we are. We're using the same language, but we're not meaning the same thing. Therefore, the Missouri Synod did not sign on to it. Okay, this is basically what Melanchthon did. Okay, this Leipzig intern, we're going to write it. It's going to sound good. It's not going to offend either side. And he could do this. He was smart enough to do this. Okay, so what you have now is a situation where you have basically two camps within the Reformation in Germany. You have one camp that becomes known as the Philippists. And you can imagine, because they're taking the path of Melanchthon. They support Melanchthon and say, yeah, you know, we're not going to get everything we want, but this is as good as we can do right now. We want to, if we don't do this, they're saying we could lose everything. Okay, you kind of understand that position. Okay, the problem with that is, and history bears this, that we see it in our American church over the last few decades, if you go this route of compromising and trying to please everyone, what eventually happens? It falls apart, and you lose the soul of what it was all about anyway. I mean, and this has happened so much in the American church, and this is where a lot of this stuff you see happening is driven from. I'm not just talking about the Lutheran church, but just the church in general. We want to save the institution. Not at our church. We have a good mix of ages. But in a lot of churches, look at this. All I see is people with no hair and white hair out here in the pews. So in 20, 30 years, is the church even going to be here? Is it even going to be here? Because all these people are probably not going to be here in 20 or 30 years. So what, in that panic, what do many churches and denominations and all gurus say we need to do? Compromise. Okay, we got to appeal to young people and different kinds of people and stuff. And there's some good in that, right? We want everyone to come into the Lord's house. But my point is, if you save the institution, we have a temporary sign right now, but say in 100 years, if there's still a sign out there that says Christ the King Lutheran Church and people are still coming in this building, but when they come in, they're not hearing the gospel, really. They come in and the sacraments aren't rightly administered. What good is it? You've saved the institution, but it's not really a church anymore. Okay, maybe it's a good place to get some self-help or practical things for your week. It's a good thing to get some good pizza or something, whatever people are doing in 100 years. So my point is, you can try to save the institution, but if you lose the soul of what it is, if something changes too much, it may have the same name, but is it even really that anymore? Okay, and I think you have a lot of examples of that. I mean, if McDonald's says, well, you know, everybody's becoming vegetarian, so we got to stop selling hamburgers, McDonald's might survive, but is it really McDonald's without burgers and fries? David says, no, I'm with you. I'm with you, brother. Yes. You know, a McDonald's without hamburgers, it may be called McDonald's, but it ain't really McDonald's. Okay, all right? So a church without the scripture, without Christ, without the gospel at the center, is it even really a church? I'm saying no. And this is going on all over the place. You know, we've got to reimagine Christianity for it to survive. It's been happening for a long time. But we see it happening, especially with our evangelical friends now, because they're starting to see the same thing. And the problem with it, it usually doesn't work anyway. Because, too many rabbit trails, but this is maybe a little rabbit trail, but I think it's important because these kind of things come up in the church. It doesn't even usually work, because I think if an organization who's supposed to stand on truth, right, if they send the message, if not explicitly, but the tone of the message, really that doesn't matter anymore, and you can really pretty much believe and do as you please, is that an organization that people are going to want to commit to and come to and, you know, get up early on Sunday morning? I don't think so. So what we've seen in America is, and some of this is demographics, obviously, as people, you know, the population ages and changes demographically. But all of the churches that have gone down that road have hemorrhaged people. They're all in worse shape than they were before. Okay, so they've taken this path of trying to accommodate everything and everybody, and they're still losing people. And I'm not a prophet, but that's what's going to happen with our evangelical friends, too. In about 20 or 30 years, they're going to realize, you know, where are all the folks? It's like, well, you kind of abandoned everything you said you were supposed to believe in. I mean, you know, why would I waste my time? You know, I can go play golf or something, right? You know? Okay? Go have a deer stand or whatever you want to do. Okay? All right, so this is the problem. All right, so the other group, though, that said no compromise, no matter what, these are the hardliners. These are the hardliners. They were called the Genesio Lutherans, which means the genuine Lutherans, they called themselves. We are the real deal, not those Philippists. They're the compromises. They're the watered down. They're the seeker-sensitive people, we would say today. We're the real Lutherans. Now, this divide and controversy really goes into the 1570s. But this is the response of the territories that have been conquered. Some say, let's go along with the compromise and try to endure. Others say, no, we got to fight it. And whatever happens to us, but we can't compromise on anything. All right, these are the two factions. Okay? All right, I mentioned Elector Maurice. And Elector Maurice is a typical politician in many ways. Why does he say, oh, I'll take that position, my cousin's in prison. I'll take that position because he wants power, right? He wants to be ruler, and I'll play ball with Rome because they're going to back me up. They're controlling everything. Oh, yeah, I saw the armies marching through Wittenberg. So Maurice, he has worked with Charles V in Melanchthon. He has taken the side, hey, I'm going to try to be buddies with both of those factions, and I'll stay in power, and I'll get money, and, you know, all the benefits of leadership. But what Elector Maurice realizes, he doesn't really have a religious awakening, but as politicians often do, what does he realize about the people that he's ruling? They didn't want him there. Why? Because who did most of the people agree with? They agreed with the folks that said, we're not changing anything. Man, is that shocking Germans would say that, right? We're not changing anything. We're keeping it the same way. Okay. So, you know, even though 30 years before they were doing something different. You know, once something happens in the church, it's like it always was that way, right? You ever had that? People talk about changing something and you're like, we can't change that. We've always done it that way. It's like, well, we used to not do it that way. But once you change it, it will never change without a fight. Okay. It's been happening since Jesus walked the earth, you know, even if it did. So they say, we're not changing. So the people's hearts were really not with these interims. They were with, we got to keep the scripture at the center. We're going to do, you know, if they had t-shirts, they'd have a picture of Luther. It says what he said, you know, we're going to do what he said. Okay. So they don't, so Maurice, okay, we're up to 1552 now. And so this has been a few years. He is able to rally forces, and what does he do? He really stabs Charles V in the back. And he says, I'm going with the other side now, because that's where the people are. So he gets his army together, and they actually defeat the Holy Roman Empire in 1552 in this area. Not the whole empire, but they're able to basically drive them out of Saxony. Okay? So now, the Holy Roman Empire and Charles, this is when he gets frustrated and quits not long after this, they are in a position where they have done all this, They've done all this and it still hasn't worked. Right? The people are still holding to the teaching, the Pope is not our boss, and it's justification by faith. Because all this stuff is in writing, it's out there. And many people have been willing to resist it. So at this point, what does the Holy Roman Empire do? Once they're defeated by Maurice's forces? Well, there's a couple treaties that are signed. The Treaty of Passau and the Treaty of Augsburg, 1552-1555. Essentially, what are they saying here? Again, think politics here. They want the territory, but now they are willing to do what? They are willing to basically compromise themselves. Because this is getting way too hard and taking up us for time. So they come to the realization, the powers that be, these territories are not going to become loyal Catholics again anytime soon. It ain't changing. They fought us this hard on it. Now we got to deal with another leader who thinks, you know, we're weak. So they realize that they're not going to change the hearts and minds. But as long as they're politically loyal, they're still part of the empire, right? Okay? So these treaties, basically what they say is something pretty revolutionary for the time. It's not modern religious freedom yet, but we're getting there. And what do these treaties say about the religion in a certain territory?
States' rights.
States' rights. So whoever is the ruler, if Maurice says, I'm a Protestant, guess what? His little kingdom will be Protestant. But if down the road somebody says, well, I'm Catholic, the ruler, guess what? They're going to be Catholics. So this establishes a principle that basically says the religion follows the ruler. So again, you're made up of all these different little kingdoms, princedoms, and whichever one that ruler is, that's what the religion's going to be. So the Holy Roman Empire basically accepts, you know, that not everybody's going to be Catholic in the empire anymore. We're going to allow them to practice whatever, you know, their brand is of religion without trying to stop it anymore. And that way we keep the empire together, we end all these wars, and then everybody will get along, we'll say. And it did preserve the empire for a while. Again, you can preserve something, but you're at the same time laying the seeds for its downfall. And, you know, there's many things that happen like that in the church, you know, with different groups. So, the other thing it said was, let's say that you are a Lutheran and your prince is Catholic. So you're going to live in a Catholic territory. What can you do? What does it say? What's the other part of these compromises or these treaties? You can move to another territory. We're not going to throw you in jail. We're not going to beat up your family. You know, you have the right to use your 2 feet or your ox cart or whatever you have. You can leave and go next door where there are Lutherans. Vice versa for Catholics. You're living in Saxony. It's now Lutheran. Well, you're welcome to go to the next territory. Okay, because especially in southern Germany, what is Germany today? Again, many of those territories remain Catholic. Okay? So, again, is that complete religious freedom? Because what if we said in Georgia, we said in Minnesota, everybody's got to be Lutheran. If you don't like that, you can leave. We would say that's outrageous, right? This is America. It can be whatever. But was this a step? I mean, think of the time we're living in. You don't follow the right religion, you could have your head taken off. Now it's toleration. It's saying we can have variance by area, and we're not going to persecute people. They are free to leave. Okay, they're free to leave and go where people believe like they do. So again, this is laying the groundwork. Again, we're not going to get there. You know, in America, when we establish the Constitution, we say there's no state religion. We're not there yet. Okay, but this is a start, isn't it? And it's going to reduce these conflicts that we've been talking about. So these treaties are important things for Lutheranism surviving. So again, God can even use political leaders. Again, Maurice, as far as I know, he wasn't a particularly devout person himself. He didn't have a religious awakening. But did God use him to help preserve the Reformation? You better believe it. He may have been acting purely out of self-interest, but by using his power to basically give the Holy Roman Empire a hard time, we get these treaties out of it. Okay? All right, so that's an important step. Now, we're out of time. So we're going to wrap it up here, and we should finish this lesson up next week, but there's still more. But basically where we are now, okay, politically, the empire said, you guys want to be Lutherans? You be Lutherans. Go for it. In your little, you, whatever Lutheran territories, you have it. Be Lutherans, whatever you want. However, now, since we've been wrestling with all of this, what does it mean to be a Lutheran, though? What does that mean? What are we supposed to believe? What is the basis for our belief? Well, so maybe we better figure that out. Okay, so that's where we are now. Now it's really a theological struggle. Okay, you get to call yourselves Lutherans, but what does that mean? Okay, many people say today, I'm a Christian, but what does that mean, though, to them? Okay, so what does that mean? What are the beliefs? All right, so we'll